Freud said the reason for therapy is to help people take neurotic conflict and turn it into normal problems. You cannot live without problems. And I think that what this can do, number one, is show you how, yes, to stay physically more healthy, but also how to deal with all the adversity and afflictions. Jung said the reason for therapy is to help you live a normally disillusioned life. And Woody Allen said life is full of miserableness, loneliness, unhappiness, and suffering, and it's all over much too quickly. My message is not that I can cure every disease, but I'm trying to heal your life. The fact that I say you can't separate yourself and your life and your disease is not to say that you caused it or it's your fault. But I do say you have responsibility to where you go from here and that you participate in what happens to you. What I'm saying is, in a sense, you have failed life if you haven't lived. That's the scary part, see, to get to your deathbed and say, my God, I never lived. And I'm trying to help people live before they die. One of the things I began to see, and I often tell his story, is a wonderful gentleman named John Florio. At age 78, he was thinking of retiring as a landscape gardener. So he was making plans. His stomach began to bother him. He had an x-ray and it showed an ulcer. And so they gave him treatment and said, come on back in a month, we'll repeat the x-ray. A month later, it looks malignant. It's biopsied and it's a far advanced, very rapidly growing cancer. So he sent to my office in the latter February, and I said, John, I need to operate before I go on vacation because this is really serious and I don't want to delay. And he said, you forgot something. I said, what did I forget? He said, it's springtime. I'm a landscape gardener. I don't have time right now to have surgery. I want to make the world beautiful, then I'll be back. That way, if I survive, great, but if I don't, I've left a beautiful world. In the middle of March, actually March 16, 1983, we operate on John, and the pathology report that I can practically recite because I've read it so many times showed 7 of 16 lymph nodes positive for tumor, cancer growing into retroperitoneal fatty tissue around the stomach, cancer present where I cut across the stomach trying to remove it, and there he sits with more cancer in his body. So at the end of surgery, when he's awake a few days later, I said, John, you need more treatment. He said, you forgot something. I said, what I forget? He said, it's still springtime. I don't have time for all those treatments. And off he went. In 5.5 years, he's had 2 visits to my office. One for an upset stomach 2 weeks after surgery, which I thought was cancer, was a virus. 4 years later, he returned, and when I saw his chart, I thought, well, something's wrong, or he should be dead. And I said to the nurse, you have the wrong chart. She said, no, he's sitting in there. So I opened the door, and there he is. And I said, what are you doing here? And he said, don't forget, it's my second visit, which I thought was to get the insurance to cover it. And then I said, but why are you here? He said, oh, I have a hernia from lifting boulders in my landscape business. That man is now 83 and a half with no sign of cancer. And that's why I know that the pathology report and the statistics have no relevance to an individual. And you could say, well, what happened to his cancer? Why did it go away? And I'd say the cancer is either enjoying John's life so much that it doesn't want to bother him, or he has eliminated it because he's outdoors, working under the sky, enjoying life, literally, as he put it, saving the lives of marigolds. And I think that will to live, that joy of living, is physiologic and has changed him. And so if I were to meet you in my office, I could literally look at you and with honesty say, here are the facts, here are the statistics, even here's the diagnosis. Now let's teach you how to be a successful patient. Let's show you what others have done who have been successful. I can literally, as I say, have that hope because I know the individual sitting in front of me. And believe me, there were many evenings that I sat in my office when I started doing this work thinking, why am I sitting here so late? This person in front of me is going to die anyway, and why am I spending all this time and doing all these things? But lo and behold, 5 years later, they walk up to me and say, hello, remember me? And then I say, hey, it's okay to sit in the office because these people in front of you aren't going to be dead, many of them. And many of them are going to call you up as they have and said, you know, I didn't die because you said I didn't have to. And that bit of hope is what turned them around. And I think hope is real for every individual. Whenever students or other physicians say to me, but you're giving false hope, I say, all right, define it. And then they go, I say, right, there isn't any. Hope isn't statistical. I mean, you can have 99 people out of 100 die of a disease, but is that a reason that one can't have hope? And so why not give the 100 hope that they can be the one? I think there is false no hope. I know that doctors are killing a lot of people, as well as articles, because they say there's no hope. But it isn't true. We are now beginning to see not only cancer survivors, different neurological diseases like multiple sclerosis and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, but AIDS survivors too, who have even reversed their blood tests. You see, suddenly it's popping up in the literature, as well as at meetings, people saying this. So there is hope for every individual. And it is when you tell people there isn't that I think you really take away something that you don't know about. How I back this up always is with money. Because what I would say to any physician is, if you're willing to bet me a year's salary against my year's salary, that I will read a pathology report, and if you can guess within 6 months of when that individual died, then you get my year's salary. If you miss, I get yours. And every doctor says, well, wait a minute. You can't predict like that from a report. Then I say, then why do you do that when they're sitting across the desk from you in the office? You tell people when they're going to die. If you don't know and you're not willing to put your money behind it, then don't kill anecdotes. And that's another way I get people to survive, because physicians say to me, well, you're not talking statistics and you're not this and you're telling stories and they're all anecdotes. I say, wonderful. If an anecdote walks into your office, don't kill them. Let them survive. Let them be an anecdote. I started doing this because I found that stories were less controversial, that when I presented things at a medical meeting or at the hospital with statistics, we argued about the different articles and the different statistics. You just start yelling at each other. But when you tell stories, people don't yell. They listen, and then they say, well, that's just a story. I say, that's right. Maybe someday a story will walk into your office or keep your eye out for one. But we leave friends, and we leave a little more open-minded because they do go back to their office, and then I get a call saying, oh, you know what? Look what happened, what you were talking about. Or here's a patient that's driving me crazy, but you'll love. And that gives people the right to survive, in a sense, in that doctor's office. The problem is people get diseases, and medicine really falls short in the treatment of people who acquire these diseases. I see medicine as a very mechanistic, cure-oriented specialty, that we are oriented towards disease, and we are working at curing everything. The problem is, as you look back at medical history, I was reading a book called The Horse and Buggy Doctor by a Dr. Hertzler, who was a general practitioner in the Midwest, and the book starts out, God Save Us from Diphtheria. And today, nobody's running around in a panic over diphtheria, but a lot of books start out, God Save Us from AIDS. 50 years from now, there'll be books that start out with a new disease, and nobody's afraid of AIDS. And I think that this is what physicians have to realize. Every generation has something it dies of. And what we really need to do is focus on people. Recently, I talked to a lady who had a heart-lung transplant at Yale. We gave her a new heart and new lungs, and she's alive today. But she said to her surgeon, I'd like to see a psychiatrist. I really need to talk about my feelings. Somebody had to die for me to live. How do I thank their family? And he said, basically, get on your exercise bicycle and work it out. And I think that's where medicine fails. We're not treating people. In medical school, what we focus on from day one, in almost all medical schools, a few are beginning to change, is the disease. And so by the time a person shows up in your third or fourth year, you focus on disease, not the person. And therefore, we are focusing on sickness, and we're telling people who are really sick to come back to the office frequently. If you do well, we tell you not to come back or come back next year for a checkup. So what begins to happen is your office, your waiting room, is filled with sick people. And the ones who do well are told not to return or don't ever come. And I began to realize that medicine is probably the only failure-oriented system. I mean, who would ever run a business based on failure? Now, if you have a good salesman, you say to your other salesman, find out what that fellow's doing and mimic him. We're making a tape to teach you how to be a successful patient. But medicine has never stopped to say why. And what medicine has done is, if you are successful, they give the disease credit. And so you were told, well, you had an error in diagnosis, you had a slow-growing tumor, you had a weak AIDS virus, you had a spontaneous remission or a miracle. And you say, well, what is that? How can I get one? And they say, well, we don't know. They're spontaneous and miraculous. I used Solzhenitsyn's term from his book Cancer Ward, self-induced healing, as a real awakening to me. He also symbolized it as a rainbow-colored butterfly, which really is what I learned, that the butterfly is a symbol of change, the rainbow is your life. When people learned they were going to die and changed their life, a lot of them didn't die. And again, this is what I began to say to people. Let's look at successful patients. We can make a list of what they do. They may all have different personalities and backgrounds, but when they sum up what they've done, it's teachable. And you can literally give a list and say, okay, here's what you need to do. This will help you survive. But the real issue, and I have to keep repeating this because I don't want to set people up to fail, is these were people who didn't deny their mortality and didn't set out to not die. They set out to live. The byproduct of living is a physical improvement and change in your body. what these people have in common, number one, is that generally the medical profession and the head nurses on the ward don't like them. Because the word patient means submissive. And so when you hear from the head nurse that you've got a real nuisance on the ward, and when you hear from a doctor that you've got a patient that's so hard to have a good relationship with and comes in with 300 questions and just drives you crazy, my response is, great, they're going to live longer. So it's easy to shift the nurses around. They can understand that maintaining individuality, keeping clothes on, decorating your room, asking questions, because cure and curious have the same root as words, are positive behavior. It's harder to get physicians who say, look, I've got a busy office, I don't have time for your questions. That could kill people. So exceptional patients are exceptional in a sense that they maintain their individuality, are not submissive, good patients. That's something, again, that people have to learn to assert themselves, that you're not a doormat. I mean, if you grew up as a doormat and the doctor says, I don't have time for you and your questions here, come to the hospital tomorrow, take this medicine, you do it. But your way out of it often then is to get sick, have reactions, so that you're then given permission to not do things. And I say assert yourself. And a part of what I've begun to share with patients is, and I don't even like the word patient, by the way, I'm coming up with a new term called respite. So you'll be a responsible participant in your care, not a patient. Was to think in terms of something like the Serenity Prayer approach, because these people all often have a spiritual faith. And I didn't use the word religion specifically, but there's an element of spirituality in these people. And so I say combine the Serenity Prayer approach, meaning that you should have the courage to fight, to change the things you can, the serenity to accept the things that you can't, the wisdom to know the difference. And the difference comes in you fight for your individuality. You're not a disease, you're a person. There are some things you're going to have to leave to God, and you're going to have to be smart enough to know which. Beyond that, I'd say it has to do with that kind of assertiveness, willingness to express emotions, just a whole host of things that are survivor personality aspects that, you know, we can get into more later. But I think that those are things that you begin to see. And I think the most important thing is to understand and be empowered by the fact that I, as a physician and authority figure, are telling you it's okay to not be liked by your doctor and your head nurse. I didn't say to keep that up, because I think you need to develop a relationship. And it may be with a hug. It may be by saying, I'm a human being and I need you. And it may be by changing doctors. But that part has to be worked out so that you have a team effort. I think the most important thing that the program can do is help you live. I can't help you not die someday. I think we can help you live longer and enjoy living. Because the sadness is that most of the world doesn't enjoy living. I'm reading, again, Ivan Ilyich by Tolstoy, and it said something like, Ivan Ilyich had a simple and comfortable life, and therefore a most terrible life. And I think most of us are living this simple, comfortable, unexpressed life, and it's a horror. You're trapped. And get out and live. Be yourself. Probably the most sad thing that I discovered was that there are a lot of people who don't want to live, and so who don't use their energy and their life force. They are not thinking about, why am I getting up tomorrow? And what do I have to contribute to the world? What I'm trying to say to people is, how do you want to contribute love to the world? That's what you have to figure out. And I think when that happens, your life force and energy is turned on, that there are live messages given to your body and physiological changes that happen. And when you're getting up every day saying, oh, God, I hate what I have to do today, or on my examining table, I'll make this marriage work if it kills me, and someday my day will come. I don't know if your day will ever come. When that lady learned she has breast cancer, she said, whoops, I'm going home and change my marriage. And I think that when you see people begin to do that, that's using your life force. And years later, that lady's full of pizzazz and alive, you see, and really learning to love and develop new experiences. And I know people who were afraid to go out in the rain, and I mean this literally, wouldn't write a check, who are in political rallies, going down the rapids in canoes, and their kids are staring at them saying, what happened to this woman I knew, my mother, years ago, who wouldn't go out in the rain? Here you are, canoeing down rapids. Yeah, but she learned that she's not going to live forever. And so then the life force was initiated. Many of us, when we haven't been loved, and then we learn we have an illness, say, oh, well, my parents always told me I was a failure, so now I'll just lie down and die. One lady in our group said, I'm trying hard to die. My bone scan's better. I can't even do that right. And people laughed at her, and that saved her life. She realized what an incredible mess she'd made out of her life, specifically failing at everything to keep living out her mother's prophecy. You learn to say, I am going to let go of the past. And it includes forgiveness, because your parents had parents. All authority figures had parents who made a mess out of them also. And so you just let go of that, forgive those people, unburden, and move forward. I think then your full life energy is activated. And I talk about burning out versus getting sleepy. I think that I can get sleepy, but if I enjoy living and if I'm loving, I am never going to burn out because I love my work. I often say that the greatest disease that we have is unloved children. I'm amazed how often the audiences applaud, and they're applauding out of their pain. They want you to know they've been unloved, and we have to change that. I grew up with a happy childhood, with parents who loved me, and was unhappy because I became a doctor. I didn't know what to do with all the love and caring. I mean, nobody taught me in medical school how to use it, so I was a disturbed adult who then began to see that the people I was caring for and trying to get better hadn't been loved. So some of them were trying to die. They were going through treatment because they didn't like how they were dying. But I had to awaken to the fact that most of them came from homes where they haven't been loved. And I'd say 3/4 of us are like that. You know, I'm not blaming parents. It has to do with a lot of factors. But when you haven't been loved, and I say to you, you're lovable, you say, well, what are you talking about? I mean, I'm not lovable. I've never done anything right. I don't look right. I never got the right grades. I didn't have the right job. Nothing's ever worked out. Then I say, all right, anybody in this audience born unlovable? Nobody raises their hand. I say, well, then who did it to you? It must have been some authority figures. I'm an authority figure. You're lovable. That settles it. That's where the work is. I mean, that you have to work to learn to love yourself again. You have to look at those negative messages and really begin to affirm yourself. And it's hard work. I keep saying, that's why by the time I finish giving people a list on how to learn to love yourself, they say, never mind, operate. Because it's much more distressing and disturbing. When I send out 100 letters to people with cancer years ago, well, 10 years ago, as a matter of fact, that we started this work, I thought hundreds of people would show up in my office to join our groups, and 12 answered. Then I began to realize, you see, I threatened them. I didn't know I was threatening them because I said, come. It's a nice letter. It said, come to the office. We'll talk about our feelings. We'll draw some pictures. We'll read some books. We'll stop being victims. It'll help you live longer and better. And then you realize if you don't love yourself, you don't go to the meeting. You don't put on a seatbelt. You don't stop using poisons. You know, you're living out the message you received. And to turn that around takes a lot of courage. Really. It's not just that you get whacked on the head, because we all learn we're mortal. And many of us learn it and lie down and die in 24 hours. I see this in the hospital, too. But then you see the others who say, if I'm not going to live forever, then I am going to have a moment to be myself. Well, I hate to announce this, because I know a lot of people are going to hear this tape, but lovers, joggers, vegetarians, and non-smokers all die. And in all the research I've done, I've never found anybody who doesn't die. And so if you do things to not die, you're going to be a failure. I mean, you imagine, this has happened at one of our workshops, a man came in who'd eaten vegetables for 18 years and got leukemia. He was furious. I mean, imagine eating all those vegetables and getting sick anyway. And I said to him, you ate vegetables for the wrong reasons. That I'm trying to help people live. You want to exercise? Fine. You want to eat vegetables? Terrific. Does it make it feel better? Does it improve the quality of your life? If it does, as I say, the byproduct is physical. There's no question that the right state of mind has more to do with the future. I mean, really, in terms of disease, when you look at research, you will find the abused child is the sick adult. So what we're trying to do is help people get rid of those old messages, forgive their parents, start living, and then a lot of healing occurs. And if you're doing it, though, as I said, to not die, then you're wasting your time. Because someday, I think George Bernard Shaw said, don't try to live forever, you won't succeed. But when people are saying, I would like to experience something before I die, then something wonderful can happen too. We were recently on television with 4 long-term AIDS survivors, and the lady said, when you live in your heart, magic happens. That's a powerful sentence for me. And this is what I see, that when people say, oh, I hear I'm going to die, that I'm going to live in my heart, I'm going to love. And then magic happened for her, and her positive AIDS blood test went back to normal. And here she is years later, not dead and healthy and helping other people. And what I'm saying to people is, out of adversity, out of the fact that you learn you're mortal, you may heal your life. And then you can literally be grateful to your disease. I don't think I have a right to say to you, your disease is a gift and a challenge. and something really wonderful has happened to you. But I can also tell you I have looked at 500 people with AIDS and said that to them because I know them, and to 1,000 people with cancer and said that to them. And when I say that, I don't mean over the years. I'm talking about sitting in an audience, you know, in a church or a hall, and all those people in front of me when I say you've got a gift and an opportunity here. And they don't throw things at me and they don't run out. What they understand is that they have an opportunity to learn to love and transform their lives because of this pressure that's been put on their reset button by their disease. And so I can't say to people, and I don't think I could have, and I know I wouldn't have said that 30 years ago as an intern when I biopsied somebody and they had breast cancer, that I could have walked into the recovery room, told them they had breast cancer, and finished the conversation by telling them that they have an opportunity and a gift here. But I have done it now as a surgeon because I know how to talk to people, and I know their life, and I know their pain, and I know that because of the cancer, they will now go home and learn how to say no and transform it. And so a week later, people come in and say, I'm worrying less. There are benefits to having this disease. I am looking at the world differently. I am taking some time for myself. Yeah, they want to be well, but they also would not give up what they have learned from the illness. Because I think if I said to them, okay, you can give up your illness, but you go right back to being your old self, many of them would say, oh, no, I can never do that. I'll accept the illness, and I also will take the gifts that came with it. When I think about how you can be an exceptional patient and how you would deal with your physicians, I cannot help but think of anecdotes of special people who have been at the operating room door. One gentleman with a brain tumor, Mike Stratton, he's a very big man, about 6'3" or so, and as the neurosurgeon came down the hall, he reached out to shake hands, and the neurosurgeon said, no, no, no. And Mike thought, well, he's afraid I'll hurt his fingers. He said, well, pat me on the head. And he said, no, no, we're running late. Let's get in the operating room. And Mike said, if you're not going to shake hands, pat me on the head. You're not going to touch my brain. Get me another neurosurgeon. And I say that that makes a mess out of the operating schedule, but it changes that relationship because you're not going to be the submissive, inadequate patient. And a lady who wanted to bring a tape recorder in. The nurse said, no, you can't. And she said, well, then I'm not going, but it's easy to get by a nurse. But then the surgeon showed up and said, where are you going with that paraphernalia? She said, into the operating room. It's a Bernie Siegel meditation tape. He said, you can't take it in there. It's my operation. She said, it's mine too. And if it doesn't go in, I don't go in. And he said, oh, well, keep the volume down. Those people have asserted themselves. And I think asserting yourself in the face of authority is one of the things that's important with the medical profession. Reading some of Carl Menninger, the psychiatrist's work, in one of his books, it mentioned that the desire to cure stems from reaction formation to our destructive tendencies. And so many doctors have underlying, basically destructive tendencies. And to hear a story, like a woman said, the doctor opened the drawer, pulled the stick out, said, it's the only thing that'll help you. She said, what is it? He said, a magic wand. And she said, he smiles and keeps the stick in his drawer. Obviously, you get out of there. What you do, I think, when you go into the doctor, is say, look, I'm a human being and I need you in this way. And I need you to help me and guide me through this experience. Because that's, I think, what physicians ought to be. Like in Dante's Inferno, Virgil represents a guide through hell. And if the physician would guide people through the experience instead of just treating the disease. So you have to say, I need a guide. I will need somebody who cares. I am not a statistic. And I will need you to help me as a human being. And then I'd say, touch your doctor. If your doctor says, don't touch me again, get another one. And I know some of you may be trapped in insurance plans or HMOs where you say, well, I can't get another doctor. Then I'd say, make an appointment and say, look, I have to talk to you as a person, not about my disease. I can tell you what one lady did. She wore an Egyptian belly dance outfit to her office visit. And that's going to make her a patient, you know, not breast cancer. Because once you do something like that, it says, hey, I'm a person. So touch, dress, share, talk, but become a human being. I think that's the key in the doctor-patient relationship. And my new word, as I said, respite, to be a responsible participant. This is a team effort. Interview doctors, check out waiting rooms. I mean, find a place that's comfortable and somebody who will answer your questions. And if you are pushed out of the office because he or she, as a physician, is running late, then you're really saying it's okay for me to die as long as your office is on schedule. And I think that is inadequate and inappropriate, that what's important is you as a human being and getting your needs met. I really feel that I get a lot of credit for writing and telling you what others have taught me. Really, it's almost like deceiving you because you think this is something you originated and learned. But where I have learned all this are from survivors. You know, as I said, 10 years ago, I started the groups called Exceptional Cancer Patients. They taught me what living was about. I thought I knew something and would teach them, but boy, they've been my teachers. And so when I meet special people, they are an inspiration to be with, first of all. And number two, they continue to teach. Physicians have not been brought up properly. Let me say this also, because I may sound awful as regards the medical profession, but I think a large part of it is. But it is not because we set out to be villains. It is our training is villainous. And I try to make it very clear that you try being an oncologist or surgeon for a month and let me know how you feel at the end of that time. It's a tough profession in terms of being unprepared for all the feelings. So when I speak at medical school graduations, I see eager young faces, you see. You meet them 20 years later, they're all depressed, and people are telling horrible stories about what terrible doctors they are. But, you know, there are many good doctors out there, too, who are picking up this message and changing. But I think it's the training that needs to be changed. And so I think you have to let the physician know that. The other is that one morning when I was going to speak at the Cornell University Medical School graduation that afternoon, I asked two young people, one with extensive breast cancer, the other with cystic fibrosis and liver failure, who died within a few months of that day, so you know how critically ill they were. I said, what do you want from the medical profession? What shall I tell these 100 new doctors to do for you? And the five things they said were, let me talk first, knock on my door, say hello, say goodbye, and look me in the eye when you talk to me. And then the medical students look up stunned because nobody said cure cancer, nobody said get me a liver transplant, they said treat me like a human being. And that has to be emphasized because our training emphasizes the disease, not the human being. And I think when you bring the human being into it, then some wonderful things happen. What have I done to humanize myself? Well, along the way to become Bernie, not Dr. Siegel. Because Dr. Siegel is rigid, fixed. You know what to expect from Dr. Siegel. And as a matter of fact, one of the nurses in the operating room often says to me when I come in, who's here today, Bernie or Dr. Siegel? If it's Dr. Siegel, I'll get a hug. I mean, she knows where I'm at. If it's Bernie, here's a human being we can all deal with. And when I started in the groups and said to them, truthfully, when they began to look and feel better, I said, you have to break this up and go home. You're getting well for illegitimate reasons. I felt like I had given them the false hope that I didn't understand. And they said, look, you don't understand because you're a doctor. Sit. You know, we'll teach you. And so I said, okay, then I'll be Bernie. And I'll sit and I will share my life and my pain so that if I say to you, this is how you ought to live with your children or your disease, you can say, is that how you live with your kids? And I didn't hide my life from them and use my life as a teacher because with five children and so forth, there aren't too many afflictions we have avoided. And so I learned about myself as they learned about themselves. And then, as I said, the other is not being afraid to be yourself. That what is it like to have a surgeon walk up to you in the emergency room and say, here's a box of crayons, will you please draw a picture for me while we're waiting for your blood tests? Or to put them up and say, look, you see these drawings? They give us a physical diagnosis. And people say, oh, wow, that's interesting. But you have to have courage to be a surgeon with a box of crayons in your pocket and to begin to do these things. Or to wear a little pin with a rainbow on it and your name on it as your name tag rather than the big square with all the fancy credentials on it. And I think these are things I began to do because I just wanted to be me. I wanted to be free to have pain. I wanted to be free to feel. I wanted to be free to even make a mistake. I mean, I'm human, see, and that people could then restore me. And I said for 2 years, I need to hug you to people until I heard the first two words where I need and realized I'm the one who wants it. And even when I said to somebody who had cancer, they hugged me and restored me. And so that's why I became human. And I like to talk in the office, and I like to share, and I'd rather go home an hour later restored than not. I've been very excited to see all the scientific research that's been done. Some of it has been hastened by the AIDS epidemic. I'm not happy about AIDS, but I'm happy about the work it is fostering because we are changing the politics and economics behind the research, that we're asking new questions and looking at things in a new way. And when my book first came out, an editorial came out in the New England Journal of Medicine after an article that said psychosocial factors in disease didn't affect outcome. And the quote from an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine was, laughter is a worthy end in itself, but not as a means or a medicine toward curing disease. On the other hand, if you now go down to National Institutes of Mental Health and talk to Candace Pert, who is a neuropharmacologist, she will tell you, quote, the medical profession has to confront this thing we call the mind. And that we are a body-mind. And so I say laughter, love, hope are physiologic. and that what we're talking about are chemicals in your body called neuropeptides that are manufactured in the brain, manufactured by cells in your immune system too, and communicate. So you communicate not only neurologically, but chemically. And the person who is full of love and full of hope and laughter has a different internal environment and has a different immune system. And in a sense, you know, when I say something as simplistic as happy people don't get sick, what we're saying is your state of mind has to do with what happens to you and when you're vulnerable. When we talk about things like identical twins or multiple personalities, you begin to see that identical twins get sick when one has a year of despair and depression, and the other, who is without that, gets by, same genes, but no disease. When you take multiple personalities, that's one individual with multiple personalities. They can change personalities. Well, let me give you a simple example. A boy wakes up in the morning, drinks a glass of orange juice, breaks out in hives, 4 hours later has a glass of orange juice and no hives. Same body, but different personalities. Wake up in the morning, you've got 12 pairs of glasses in your drawer. Why? Because you don't know what personality you'll wake up with, and your eyes are different. And this includes physical injuries, allergies, drugs, even diabetes, all kinds of incredible things when you switch personalities, change in your body. So I am saying to people, change. It's scientific. That when you change, you are not only changing yourself psychologically, but you're changing yourself physically. And the two things go together. My prediction would be that in 5 years, I hope, certainly by 10, through genetic engineering, we will be treating cancer, AIDS, and a whole host of other diseases with the neuropeptides that we now make in our bodies. Right now, the only way I can get you to manufacture these drugs is by your attitude and your emotions. But where this has been done, and it's been done on an experimental basis in a few hospitals, patients with AIDS have had their white count raised to normal. Patients who've had bone marrow transplants have had their bone marrow zipping back, growing again, because it's like a live message, a chemical message in the body that changes it. And so it's exciting. This is a whole new field that we're coming to. Mr. Wright was a gentleman whose case was written up by Bruno Klopfer in the psychology journal. And Klopfer was a psychologist on the ward. And it was a time, a good number of years ago, when the drug crobiazin was going to be tested to see if it was any use in the treatment of cancer. It was one of those alternative treatments. And so the protocol said that if you were going to live 6 months, you could be given the crobiazin, and then we have some statistical validity. On the ward was this Mr. Wright, who had a far advanced lymphoma. He was really very close to death. I mean, his tumors were like melons, so to speak. He learned that the drug was coming to the hospital, so he said, that's going to save me, I want it. Since he didn't fit the protocol, they didn't expect him to live a few days, let alone 6 months. They kept denying it to him. But he was so persistent that finally they said, look, give it to him on Friday. He'll probably be dead by Monday, and we'll just give the rest of the drug to somebody else. Well, he got his shot on Friday. When Klopfer came back to the hospital on Monday, he said, there was Mr. Wright. Quote, his tumors had melted like snowballs on a hot stove, and he was walking up and down the ward, encouraging and cheering everybody up. And he stayed perfectly well for about 2 months, until the newspaper report came out with preliminary statistics that said crobiazin does not seem to be useful in the treatment of cancer. He relapsed. And then Klopfer said, I now have a chance to see if what the quacks claim is true. And what he did was say to him, you didn't get the super refined crobiazin. That's the problem. As soon as it comes, we'll give it to you, because he let the intensity build. A week went by, gave him an injection of water, telling him it was the super refined crobiazin. He got better faster than the first time. 2 months later, he's doing perfectly well. Newspaper report comes out. Crobiazin is of no use in the treatment of cancer, and in 3 days he was dead. I mean, the exciting part of that to me is that hope can lead to healing and survival. The sad part is to tell you the other side of a similar story. A lady wrote to me, a relative of a woman, who said a doctor told my relative she'd be dead in a few weeks of cancer, brain tumor. So hearing this, she gets up and heads for Mexico and goes on Laetril. And a year later, meets this guy in the street. And he says, what's happened? Where you been? She said, well, I went to Mexico. I got Laetril, and look at me. Here I am a year later playing my piano, singing and feeling fine. He said, it's an absurdity. It's of no use. You're wasting your time. She died that night. See? And I have to ask, what have you got against deceiving somebody into help? I mean, that's the craziness of our profession. I know that I can use my reputation and what I have seen and beliefs to help people get well. It's not a deception. Getting well is not a deception. Versus telling people to die because they're supposed to. I mean, this is craziness. And I think this is our inadequate understanding of what hope means and what living your life means. And so I make use of all those expectations. And I feel I am honest about it. When we talk about how patients teach me, one gentleman I went into, I said, you have cancer. He said, I guess that means I've got 5 or 6,000 miles left. And I thought to myself, what a wonderful answer. I don't know what it means. He doesn't know what it means. But what it does mean is I can keep going. We'll make repairs. We'll change my oil, new filters, but I'm going to keep going. And so when somebody says to me, how am I doing? I say, you still got 5 or 10,000 miles left. And they look at me and smile. They don't say, what kind of a doctor tells me I have 5 or 10,000 miles left? I want the facts. What they have heard are the facts, you see, that we can keep you going. We don't know the future. Don't know if it'll be 5,000 or 10,000, but I know you'll keep going. And that's what doctors need to be able to understand. And another was a woman who kept saying to me, tell me about. And I realized what a wonderful way of asking a question, because she wasn't threatening me. Not that I would feel threatened by questions anyway. But I said to her, that's great. I'm going to teach other people. When you go to your doctor, say to your doctor, please tell me about. Instead of saying, look, I want to know what's going to happen to me and I want all the facts. You say, tell me about. And it gives that physician the comfort of saying, here's what I know about your disease and what the future holds. And there's no antagonism built up. And so again, I say, we learn from people, learn from success. And why kill Mr. Wrights or Mrs. Wrights because you think they ought to die? Give them a chance. Give them hope. I really think that the medical profession is behind quackery in the sense of creating it. That if doctors learn to give hope and prayer to each patient, you wouldn't need a quack. So you wouldn't have to go to Mexico or Europe or God knows where to find hope. Because in every waiting room, there's a 10% survival. And I mean that literally. That you go to alternative clinics and you almost always hear that they've got at least, when you look at records, a 10% survival of people who came there and were called incurable. My feeling is the waiting room gets them better. So you go into the waiting room, having traveled halfway around the world, and you sit down and say, oh, I was told by my doctor I'm going to die. And somebody in the waiting room says, oh, I came here worse than you. And look at me now. And you sit up and you start living again and you make it. The treatment may get the credit, but it's probably the guy in the waiting room who saved your life. And that's why if doctors would do that in their waiting room, say, look, there is hope. We will never run out of options. If we run out of drugs, you and I will pray together regularly. But, I mean, there will always be something we can do. And so what I present to patients is a list and say, look, here are your options. You know, they range from surgery to vitamins to all kinds of things. But here are the options. We don't stop trying. And I know a lot of people aren't dead today because I said we don't stop. Now, I might give them a list. It doesn't mean that I present them with things that I wouldn't treat my cancer with or wouldn't feel right for me. Because one lady came in, I said, what's your disease? How do you describe it? She said, I'm in prison. And I said, what do you mean you're in prison? She said, well, what would you do if you had my cancer? I said, I have an operation. She said, oh, God, operations, they hurt. I said, well, you could have chemotherapy. Oh, but then my hair fall out. I said, well, why don't you eat vegetables? Oh, I hate vegetables. I said, why don't you have radiation? She said, oh, that burns. And then you begin to realize why she's in prison, because there were no options for her. Okay? So I would present all those options to people and even give them phone numbers to call and then say, what's right for you? If you do that, especially as a physician, rather than say, you're crazy, get out of here, I don't like what you're doing, 100% of the people who have come into my office who are doing things that I wouldn't do ultimately say, you know, this is hard to get better. You care about me. It's okay to use you as a doctor. So we really become a team. It might be 3 weeks later, it might be 3 months later, but I also see patients who have been screamed out of doctor's offices who chose to die rather than see another doctor because they said, I will never go back and take that abuse again. And that's even sadder. In one hospital I worked at, we were on the sixth floor with windows, and you could look out at the world, and it made what was happening in the operating room real and smaller, too. It was only a part of the universe. And a friend of mine, Richard Selza, who was a surgeon that I worked with, wrote a story. And in it was one line where he said, when they took windows out of the operating room, they severed a celestial connection. And I think that that was powerful for me because I realized when we shut out the view, we made the surgeon God, but with a small g, even though surgeons may not feel that way. And we took away a healing energy. And so I brought music in to reconnect with that celestial element. I also began to realize from studies that were also done that if a patient was in a room with a view of the sky, they would have less pain and leave the hospital sooner. If a patient even had a view, meaning a big picture on the wall in their room of an outdoor scene, their tranquil state was enhanced over the patient who looked at a blank wall. And so now I have no hesitancy writing orders in the chart saying, transfer my patient to a room with a view of the sky. Now, I also, as I write that, think back, if I were the intern, you know, 20 years before and saw a surgeon write, transfer my patient to a room with a view of the sky, I'd say, this man's out of his mind. What does that have to do with healing? But you find yourself in a locked-in room facing a brick wall through your window and then get transferred to a room where you can see the sunrise and set, and what a different feeling it is. That whole aspect is healing. When people come into my office, I don't play God. I mean, I will tell them what they have. I tell them that I care about them. And then I tell them what I think are the best ways of treating what they have. And I will often say, if you were my wife, if you were me, if you were one of our children, this is how I would recommend you treat your cancer. Now, if that lady said, oh, but operations hurt, chemotherapy this, and radiation burns, I'd say it does for those who have a lot of conflict about it. If you choose it as your healing, you can wake up in the recovery room, hug me, say I'm a little sore, but I don't have any pain. And let's talk about giving you time to think about your options, make choices, and see how this can work out. And I think that's what I probably do more than anything, is give people time. Because people don't die if you wait 3 days to make a decision. And many doctors scream and yell, get a phone call, well, your report is here, get to the hospital tomorrow, we'll take off a part of your body. No, don't go. Say, no, I've got to think about it. People who have second opinions are more likely to be survivors, too, because they have said, wait a minute, I'm going to participate, take charge, I want some control here. And that feeling of control is important. One lady drew a picture when I asked her to draw her doctor giving her her chemotherapy. She drew the devil giving me poison. And she was sent to me by her doctor because he didn't understand her violent reactions. Now, what they were about was, number one, her family insisted she get chemotherapy. Number two, she didn't like her doctor. So her way of getting out of it, and again, a lot of it as an unconscious level, was to get so sick that even the doctor would have pity and say, oh, stop. And another boy who was put into radiation therapy by his family, they didn't give him an option, vomited at red streetlights because the red light that goes on with the x-ray machine, every red light reminded him of that. So you came to a street corner, he'd throw up. And then his family said, well, stop the radiation. It must be awful. What was awful was being out of control. And this is something I don't let people do. I don't put them out of control. I don't take over their lives. I'm there to help them and to nurture them and support them. And I don't have to agree with them. And that's something they understand, say. I mean, we could have the same disease, and I could say, I wouldn't do that. And that's all right. They say, fine, but this is my life. That's why we're a wonderful team through this whole thing. Because I'm there to love them. And as I said, that's what people thank you for. Particularly if you're dealing with an abused child who's never been loved, who gets sick, and then you say, I care. Somebody said the truth without compassion is hostility. And I think that this is what doctors tend to do to maintain control. It's part of their destructive personality aspects they're not aware of. And so they give the truth, what they think is the truth. I mean, we don't know the truth for an individual. On the other hand, if I'm going to take you into an operating room, I will share with you the possible dangers of the surgery and the anesthesia and so forth, but not in a sense of there having to happen to you. I have to tell you the relative risk. Then it's a faith relationship and the caring. And you can turn over to me, you know, your feelings of safety and warmth because somebody's caring for you. And I think that helps people survive. One study was done at this one anesthesia department. They were told you have to tell everybody what's going to happen in the operating room or you may be sued. So they looked at their records, and two of the anesthesiologists had an increase in cardiac arrest in the operating room. When they met together, they realized those two were telling everybody these things in the hallway outside the operating room. Not even the night before when people could at least adjust to it and share, but right in the hallway. And they were killing people with fear. And this is a part that happens. So, you know, you can call it voodoo death if you want to, but yeah, doctors kill people with their words. One physician, cardiologist, this was written up by a cardiologist who wrote a book, said that they were making rounds with students, and one patient that they walked into the room, they were asking the students to listen to everybody's heart to learn. And he said, here's a classical case of TS. This is a woman who's doing quite well. She has what's called tricuspid stenosis, so it makes a certain heart murmur sound. And the students listen and leave. Her pulse becomes irregular, pressure drops. The physician and nurse run back into her room and ask what happened. She said, you heard what he said, I'm a terminal situation, TS, and she was dead that evening. Another gentleman who was quite ill, they came into his room, and the head cardiologist said, here's a man with Gallop rhythm. So everybody listen. That's dilated, sick heart. It sounds like a horse's hooves, so it's called the Gallop rhythm. Everybody listens and leaves. Ultimately, the man recovers. When asked why he thought he recovered, he was so critically ill, he said, you heard the doctor. My heart is as strong as a horse. And I think this is where, you see, our words can heal and our brutal words can kill. So when a friend of ours' husband was told, I don't think you're going to make it this time, when he asked when he would be discharged, he died in 15 minutes when the doctor said, I don't think you're going to make it this time. And between the time his wife talked to him and his attitude was okay and she arrived at the hospital, he was dead. And the only thing that happened was a doctor with that sentence, I don't think you're going to make it this time. Cultivating hope, I think, has a lot to do with your own belief. I can be hopeful because I have seen so many wonderful things happen. And I think I come in with an honesty and an enthusiasm that is transferred to people. They know I'm not a deceiver. And I don't hide the facts. I mean, they know that this is a dangerous situation that they may be in, but there are things that can happen. And even if it's one in a million, I mean, what's wrong with hoping that, you know, you might make it? You might be the one. And so I offer that option to people. See, I'm always offering options. I'm not giving burdens, saying you must this or you must that. I say, how do you feel? Want to keep living? Let's do it. Evie McDonald was interesting. I was reading a last paragraph from AIDS survivors, several last paragraphs saying to people that this is the important stuff in all these interviews. And one said, I live as if it's the last month of my life. And lo and behold, I get a letter saying, you're too lenient. And Evie said, I had amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, was told I'd be dead in 6 to 12 months, and I was a bowl of Jell-O in a wheelchair and like 10 minutes from death. I couldn't even brush my teeth. And so stop telling people to live a month at a time, 10 minutes. Well, I think that's not reality for most of us. So I tell people to look at an hour at a time. And that I know we can do because I've done it. And if you don't like how you feel, let go of it. And I think that's what Evie taught me most of all. Plus one sentence that I remember, or two, in her letter to me, was, I decided to experience unconditional love before I died. And what she did, if you listen to that sentence, is didn't say, oh, I've got to not die. I've got to do something. She said, I'm going to do something before I die. Then she said, when I experienced the unconditional love, a byproduct was a physical cure, was a reversal of my illness. And that, again, she couldn't be a failure, and neither can you. If you set out to experience love, a byproduct may be a physical cure. Our daughter Carolyn gave me a cartoon. It shows a man getting up saying, I feel terrific. What a wonderful day. I'll call in sick. You begin to understand how we use or don't use illness. And literally, the people who get minor illnesses are less likely to have a major catastrophic illness because, in a sense, they use their sick days to stay healthy. My comment would be, of course, take health days and take care of yourself. And so I'm always asking people to tie together your life and your disease. That I don't think it's a coincidence when you get sick. And that, again, is not to make people feel guilty, but if you just moved across the country, had a child, new job, these are what we call life crisis units, and you accumulate those units, you're more likely to get sick. So when a lady sits on my examining table with an abscess and I say, how come, and I mean literally I do this, I walked into a lady, I've never met her before, she's there with an abscess, and I walked in, I said, hello, why do you have trouble saying no without guilt? And she looked at me and said, who called you for my family before I got here? And I said, nobody called me. I'm reading your body. And if you use your body as a sign, it will help you.
For instance, the only time I was hospitalized for a week was with a severe staph infection. Again, start practice, move to a new house, more children, lots of wonderful things, and I got sick then. And I realized that it had to do with all the changes in my life. But I also know that that bug is still in my body, and if I overdo it, I may have a little warning signal, you know, like a sty or something come up and it says, Bernie, go to bed, take a rest, have a good night's sleep. Or if I am talking too much, like we're doing here today, the part of my body that really acts up will be my larynx. And I may get a little laryngitis, and then it says, see, you can't go out and talk and do a workshop, go home and take it easy. So I listen to my body. And if I listen, I don't have these things come up. And I think, again, this gets back to saying to people, what's happening in your life? Listen to your body and what it's trying to tell you. And you, again, interrelate your life and the disease, because the answers always relate back to your life. And that's why, to make a long story short, I say, look at the distress in your life. Look at what is going on now. Look at what's happened in the last few years, or in the last few weeks, if it's some minor issue or cold, and say, how did those contribute to why I am ill at this moment? I think that empowers you. Now, if you want to, again, feel guilty because of what parents and others have done to you, fine. There are people who like to be crucified 10 or 12 times and who never choose resurrection. But I think that if you let your body help you, it'll help resurrect you, not destroy you. The word stress is really a neutral word. So you might say there's distress and eustress, E-U-S. And the eustress can be good for you. There can be people who are stimulated and excited by it. And the distress is what obviously hurts you. So stress per se makes life exciting. And one person's excitement may be another person's destructive behavior or lifestyle. And I think this, again, goes back to survival behavior. Susan Kobayashi came up with three C's, commitment, challenge, and control, you see. So in the face of stress, if you have a commitment, feel challenged, and in control, that's good stuff. And you're going to survive and get through okay. But if you feel out of control, if you don't have a commitment, if you don't see it as a challenge but as a threat to your life, you see, then you're in trouble. And that's why you get back to the spiritual flat tires and the we'll see attitude. I mean, it takes a certain attitude to confront what may seem to be adversity and say, well, we'll see what happens, you see. When somebody fires me, when my girlfriend says, no, I don't want to marry you, when you run out of money, when you have an accident, if you can step back and say, well, wait a minute, let's see what happens. And I think those are the important things to look at, because you don't know how your life is altered by one event in that sort. And I often meet people years later who say, you know, it was a good thing that that happened, because look what's come out of that. And at that moment, they didn't have time to sit back. But if they had that sort of attitude, they allowed that to happen and remained on their path in a sense. And therefore, something came out of it that was productive. And it gets back to saying thank you to the disease or difficulty and using it in a positive way. That takes, I think, individual effort. They say that pessimists have a more accurate view of the world in terms of detailed descriptions, but optimists live longer. And I think that I'd rather be the optimist and have a less accurate view of the world, because it feels better living that way. I just read a little newsletter from Norman Vincent Peale, and this high school teenager went to read a story at a home for the elderly, and she walked into Mr. Johnson, who couldn't see well, and said, Mr. Johnson, I'm here to read a story to you. How are you? And he said, I'm all right so far. And she said, what do you mean by that? He said, well, if you fall off a building as you pass each floor and people lean out and say, how are you? You can answer, I'm all right so far. And she, later in her life, really thanked Mr. Johnson, because as she ran into difficulties, adversities, new conditions, she would take a deep breath and say, but I'm okay so far. And you take it one step at a time. If I were to just simply tell people how to bring up their children, the hard part would be to say, give your child unconditional love, accept them as they are, not taller, haircut, another bath, clean your room. Remember, you don't have to like everything, but to love them unconditionally. Give them some discipline, not punishment, and then consistently say things like, life is full of problems, but whatever happens, you'll overcome and live to be 100. And if the kids hear that and have the love and discipline, they are going to go on and survive. Even after their parents are gone, those words are going to be echoing in their ears. So every time they run into trouble, they'll say, oh, well, here's another one of those things my parents warned me about, but I'm going to get over this and live to be 100. And it's a wonderful, wonderful gift to give your children those kinds of messages. from the standpoint of personality factors that predispose us to illness, I think that each type of illness has certain personality profiles. You know, we've heard a lot about heart disease and that type of aggressive individual, type A. And I think you can go on through all sorts of diseases. The things that have come up with cancer patients, I'd say, that are probably the most significant are several. One is their inability in general to have self-esteem and self-worth and be able to say yes to themselves. I like to put it that way rather than saying no to the world. But it's their self-worth, self-esteem, and ability to care for themselves, not be the doormat type person. Another element that came up in research done by Carolyn Thomas and others at Johns Hopkins was what's called a low closeness to parent profile. And it had more to do with the kind of relationship they had with their parents, where you might have a domineering father or a cold mother, those types of things. Or loss of a parent. I mean, sometimes a parent died when a child was 4 or 6, so they didn't have a parent to be close to. As also has been recently shown, even being breastfed has some statistical significance in terms of not developing cancer later. So I think that it is a relationship to the parent, probably what you might call a nurturing, close relationship to the parent. What does that do? I think it gives you a different attitude towards life in terms of what happens. It's sort of a built-in, we'll see attitude. Whereas those who haven't had that support often have this helpless, hopeless feeling. And so they also give up when that occurs. Schmale and Engel at Rochester did research in this hopeless, helpless, giving up, given up attitude. And they tell a little story, and you don't know who they're talking about because they use two names like Bill and Sally. And Bill is killed, and Sally walks up to him, lies down next to him, and dies. And then you learn it's two llamas from the Rochester Zoo that escaped. And the male was kind of wild, so he was shot. And his mate just walked up to him, laid down, and died. Right at his side, in the street. And this is what goes on, I think, with the people we're talking about. When adversity occurs, they give in. About 60 years ago, Alida Evans wrote a book called A Psychological Study of Cancer. And she also discussed the profile of people with cancer. It's a wonderful book in terms of the psychological aspects. I mean, obviously, 60 years ago, they didn't understand a lot about the disease in a physical sense or have any treatment. But she said, in a Jungian sense, that the people who developed cancer were extroverted, meaning their lives were outside of themselves. You see, they found something meaningful. And when that meaningful aspect of their life was disrupted, they became sick. They lost meaning in their life. It could be retirement. It could be, you know, divorce. It could be death of a child. But whatever they had invested their life energy in. And I think this is what you see happening in people over and over again. So I see women come into my office with breast cancer, and you say, what happened? My child climbed a tree and touched a wire and was electrocuted, or my husband left. And it goes on and on. I remember one lady who came in with many severe breast problems and a lot of pain and tenderness. And I said, what's happening in your life? And she said her husband had just run off with a younger woman. And I sat and gave her a long talk about herself and her life and why I thought what was happening in her breasts had more to do with that than anything else. And as things straightened out, and maybe about 6 months later when she was in the office again, feeling better, getting this thing with her husband resolved, and as she was about to leave, I said, wait a minute, I have one more sermon to give you. And I talked for a little bit more about living, and then she wrote me a letter. And I said, I apologize for holding you here. And she wrote back, she said, the first time I left your office, I cried all the way home, and the last time I laughed all the way home. And she said, don't ever stop giving me sermons. And I think this is what we all need, in a sense, is somebody to give us that sermon and to understand what life is about and how you interrelate all these factors, and that it's not your fault what your parents were like or how you grew up or that you weren't breastfed or nurtured or that your father was killed in an accident when you were 3 years old or died of cancer, but how you choose to relate from here on is a big part. And only when we're willing to confront our pain. You know, when I talk about our garbage disposal at home having a reset button and saying to God, why don't you give us a reset button? It would be so much nicer if every time we had trouble, you just pushed a button and got us going again. Her comment was, I gave you a reset button. It's called pain and suffering. When you hurt enough, you change. I think that's the tough part. Most of us are not willing to confront our pain, why we bury ourselves in drugs and alcohol. But when we're willing to confront our pain, some wonderful things come out of that. I think for most people, when they hear the words, you have cancer, the first thought is, what's going to happen to me? You know, you sort of take this leap into the future and start in with, oh, well, I won't see my kids graduate and I'll be dead and I'll this and I'll that. And I think that's one element of it that brings a lot of panic. Then you go through a phase of, what do I have to go through? Now, different people go through these in different orders. I mean, there's no right or wrong way, you know, to experiencing it. But another part, as I said, is, oh, my golly, look what I have to go through. Surgery, chemo, radiation, who knows what, and will they do any good, and is the treatment worse than the disease? And my hope also is that then people begin to get angry, because I think that often brings out the fighting spirit in them. So lots of times I'll say, when people use profanity and say, oh, you know, what's happened to me, I say, good, the more dirty words you say, the more likely they are to get better. I mean, because then they're beginning to get angry and start fighting back. And just as years ago Elizabeth Kubler-Ross elucidated different stages in the dying process, I think there are different stages in the process of hearing you have cancer. So anger, resentment, moving through acceptance, and a lot of things. Acceptance of the disease, but not of it as a sentence, you see, because that's the difference, I think, rather than resignation, which is what a lot of people feel. Oh, I have that, I'll lie down and die. And that, again, can get back to what your parents taught you and why that becomes important. But those who say, oh, I can accept that, now where do we go from here? Those are the people you really want to work with, you see, who open up to the options and start doing. I think it's important to realize that the feelings are simply feelings. They're not what's dangerous. What's dangerous is not expressing them. See, that's what I call a die message. And the example I give to people to get them to understand this, our Creator gave us eyes, ears, nose, mouth. You know, if I say to you, take a walk downtown, you say, okay. If I say drive, you say, fine, I can see where I'm going. But then I say, look, we're going to have a little fun. I have these opaque soundproof bags that you will pull over your head down to your ankles and tie them tightly around each ankle. Now go for a walk or drive. And you say, what are you, out of your mind? I'll get killed out there. I can't see, I can't hear, I can't smell, I can't talk. I say, right. When I come up to you, knowing your life's troubles, and I say, how are you? You smile and say, I'm fine. And then I say, that's funny. Aren't you having any problems now? You say, oh, no, nothing. That's like pulling that bag over your head because you are not feeling well. Something's happened. You're troubled. I say to you, I want to help you. And you say, no, thank you, I'm fine. What does your body hear at that moment? It hears, help has been offered, but I have refused, so I really want to die. You see, your immune system's regulated. It got a die message. You refused help, so it turns off and helps you die faster. If I come along and say to you, how are you? And you say, I am lousy. If you only knew what's going on in my life, I am in a rage. That's a call for help. And that tells your body, I may not be feeling good, but I am fighting for my life. Keep it up, folks. And the system that I have instituted, because most people don't want to say I'm lousy or worse if their friends call them, is just say, use a grading system. Tell everybody you know that if they call up and say, how are you, and you're less than a B+, they should come over, give you a hug and some therapy. And it's easy when somebody comes up to you and you try it sometime and says, how are you, say C-, and watch what happens. They'll smile, give you a hug, and it doesn't sound terrible, and it gets the door open, see? And in one hospital that I spoke at, they have hung signs around the wards saying, if you are less than a B+, let us know, we'll give you a hug. That's really what we need to do with each other. So feelings shouldn't scare you, but not expressing them should. Women with breast cancer who had a fighting spirit, about 10 or 12 years later in a study done in England, 70% are alive. The deniers, I think, were about 50%. The stoic acceptors and the hopeless, helpless group were down to 30 and 20%. So if you can keep up a denial, that's better than feeling helpless, obviously, because you walk around saying, I am fine, okay. But it's better to be a fighter, you see. And I try to convert deniers into fighters. Unfortunately, too many doctors take deniers and make them feel helpless and kill them faster. And that's something we have to wake up to and change. But the feelings, if not expressed, are the problem. Why I also use lots of drawings. When you say to people, draw yourself, in the midst of every catastrophe you can name, there's that big grin saying, I'm telling the world everything's fine, and it's so self-destructive. So if you learn only one thing from this tape, I'd say one of the most important things is to be yourself and express your feelings and don't hide your emotions. One of the things that I saw in lots of letters from people were their spontaneous beginning to keep a journal of their feelings. And that's a safe way to let it out. So number one on my list for everybody, whether you're healthy or sick, is keep a journal of your feelings and your dreams and keep them together and you can go back over them months and years later to see what you've accomplished. And what we know from studies are, particularly things like executives and college students, if you say to them, keep a journal of your feelings, then the control group is told to keep a journal of just facts, where you went, what you did all day. The ones who write their feelings down have a more active immune system and fewer illnesses during those critical periods. So it does work to let the feelings out. I would also say that as part of that, understand that feelings should not be evaluated. You are entitled to have feelings when you hear you have cancer or AIDS or multiple sclerosis. And what I would say you do with those feelings is get help. Let them out. Get a therapist. Join a group. Start keeping your journal. Get those feelings out in the open so people can respond to them and help heal you. It's the feelings that are buried and hidden, you know, that I'm fine, putting on a smile for everybody, performance that helps kill you. So let it out. Let it out. You want to go home and scream? You want to beat the pillows? You want to yell while you're driving your car? Whole host of techniques. Go ahead and do it. Get a tennis racket and smash the bed. Don't go beat somebody else up, but let it out. And if you let that rage out, then peace comes. That's the one thing I have always discovered. And I've met people, believe me, who are potential murderers because of what's happened in their lives. When they let out the rage in a safe place, they become quiet, peaceful, spiritual people because love moves in to replace it. When I work with people, I have come up with 5 questions that I think help clarify for me what kind of people they are and get them to look at their lives quickly. The first question I have is, do you want to live to be 100? And I'm looking for a gut response because the people who respond with a basic yes are saying, I'm not afraid of the future. I'm not afraid of outliving everyone I love. I'll find new people to love. I'm not afraid of illness and aging. I'm just looking at the world with a very different viewpoint. And those are the kinds of people who are survivors. I mean, all you have to do is talk to 95-year-olds to know what survival is about and what they've lived through. When people say, no, I don't want to live because I'll be handicapped, blind, sick, I get them to look at their fears, you see, and to get them to understand that they may be more willing to die at 65 than they are to be, as one lady said, the last apple on the tree. And what I'm trying to do then is say, all right, I mean, I'm not judging them. You want to die at 65 so you don't have to worry about living to be 100? That's your choice. But what I try to show them is how they can contribute. You see, that a man literally committed suicide when his doctor said, you can't sail your boat, play tennis, or go to work anymore. And what I'm trying to do, if I had been with that man, would have been to say to him, don't you think you have other things to contribute? Can't you love your kids even if you don't play tennis? Don't you have other things to give to the world? And begin to get them to see what is disability, what is handicap, you know, what can the quadriplegic do if he puts a paintbrush in his mouth, and that you have a lot of ways to continue loving and contributing despite your physical limitations or diseases. And that allows them to keep living and see that they have meaning in their life. And that's really what I want them to look at. Why are you here? What do you have to contribute? And how do you contribute it? I think the people who live conditionally are the ones living with fears. You know, I'll say yes if you tell me I'll be all right or have enough money or be able to do this or that. And I think it's just the fear that builds up. The people who don't have those fears respond with the yes, and it's easier to work with. And so when I'm thinking about what people will face, for instance, like an operation, other forms of therapy, and many choices, and it's the person who says, well, I'll do it if, those are people who are going to be harder to deal with and get through. I mean, they're not starting out as survival behavior people. And I will spend more time working with them, often with the symbols and the drawings and things, to say, all right, let's work with you, give you a few weeks to change your personality, get you into a different place before we go ahead. Because I think if we plunge in with the person who says, I don't want to live to be 100, in some of those groups, there are people who are trying hard to die. I remember Joan Borisenko presenting some research and people with melanoma saying that people who said the disease was no threat and not stressful died faster than everybody else. I said, you know, in that group, of course, because if you want to die and you get cancer, of course it's not stressful. It's your solution. So you say, hey, it's no problem. Then you go home and die. And I think those are the people I want to work with and clarify. Again, not to judge them, to say it's wrong to want to die, but to say, what do you have to contribute to the world? And let's look at that before we make choices. And so there are many people I've sat with for days and sometimes weeks and even months who aren't sure they want to have their cancer taken out or cured. And we spent a lot of time talking about life and living. And I can say honestly that every one of those people has ultimately said, okay, go ahead, let's cure the disease. I have something to contribute to the world and a reason to live. The second question is what happened the year or two before you became sick, because I want to look at the time factor involved. No matter what genes you're given, what poisons you're exposed to, there are repair mechanisms in the body too. And so your life and your disease and the onset of it, I think, are related to many, many factors. And I think change is a time when you're vulnerable. Despair and depression, particularly unspoken and unacknowledged, are probably the things that set you up for difficulty most of all. When I met identical twins, one of them died at age 29, and his brother described him, he died of cancer, as someone who was very depressed and unhappy his whole life. 30 years later, his brother walked into my office saying, I've just had a year where I have wanted to die, even thinking of suicide. Now I have cancer. And so that's why I say to people, what's going on the last year or two? Here are two men with the same genes who, 30 years apart, get the same disease. And I, again, feel it empowers you, because if you can look at your life and say, I've lost my father, I moved, I changed jobs, 6 other problems have arisen, I can say, all right, how are we going to deal with all of those? Because I think there are reasons why you're depleted and why your defense mechanisms broke down now, and let's build you up again. The next question I ask probably has created the most controversy. It's, why do you need this illness? And everybody jumps on me for saying, oh, you're making, you know, people feel guilty. I don't say all the people with disease jump on me. Obviously, what I have to say wouldn't be so popular if I created a bunch of people who feel guilty. But a lot of the medical profession jumps up and says, well, you're making people feel awful. But I want them to look at what benefits they are deriving from being sick. In the psychotherapy literature, it has, for decades, back to Jung and Freud and so forth, and others, elucidated the benefits of illness: aggressive, self-destructive, punitive, erotic, all kinds of benefits to being sick. In, again, the body sciences, so to speak, we don't look at that. But I know in one of Carl Menninger's books, he mentions a young gentleman who, because of what this man had done, leading to the death of his child, he was out of his mind, literally, until he had an industrial accident, lost his right arm. Then he became perfectly sensible and sane again, because he realized he gave up something then. It was as if he was punished enough, now he could go on. And I see the disease meaning that to lots of people. It's punishment, it plays a role, it allows me to manipulate, to not work, to do all kinds of things. And I want people to look at that so that they can meet their needs without the illness. That's really what I'm trying to get across. And to say, again, empower yourself, don't use the illness, either at a subtle psychological level or at an obvious level. But learn to say no, and you don't have to be sick to take care of yourself. The fourth question that I ask is, what does the illness mean to you? And that has a lot to do with the parental messages of earlier life. You know, is it a challenge? Is it something to overcome? Or is it something you lie down and die of because your parents taught you that? I really try to elaborate what resources people have out of that and what they see this as. It leads into the fifth question, which simply stated, what I say to people is, how do you describe your illness and what you're experiencing? And then you might think that people would say, how do I describe my illness? I have multiple myeloma. I have breast cancer. I have lupus. They don't. They say things like, on the nice side, I have a new beginning, wake-up call, beauty mark, gift, and challenge. On the other side, something's eating me up alive. I have a volcano. I have a monster inside of me. I'm a failure. I have a secret. It goes on and on. And when you say, what all these things mean, the failure is my parents committed suicide and I was a rotten kid. Something's eating me up alive inside. I'm a total doormat. My whole life is eating me up alive. A monster, the man is totally non-assertive and needs to make some noise himself. A secret, the lady hides everything in her life. And man said it's an inconvenience, which I said to him, you might die of an inconvenience. And what was going on in your life? He's putting on a performance for the neighbors so that they have no realization of how sick he is. But when he staggers in the door at the end of the day, his family has to carry him to bed. And then in the morning, they sort of push him out the door and he starts with the act again. And he's killing himself faster. And of course, having no relationship with his family. So those words, even though they are stated by the person as a description of their illness and their experience, I find always relate back to the problems in your life. And so, again, the disease becomes a way of reorganizing and rearranging your life, and in a symbolic way can really direct you around till you finally do say the disease is a gift and a challenge. And believe me, that has nothing to do with how life-threatening the disease is. The response is a gut feeling in people because of what they have done because of the disease. You may have heard or been told that what you're experiencing or your disease is a psychosomatic illness. That doesn't mean it isn't real. I think that too many people have used that term to say, oh, it's all in your mind, it's imaginary, you know, think positive and you'll be fine. It doesn't work that way. Psychosomatic illnesses are real illnesses. As a matter of fact, they probably represent 75 or 80% of what we as physicians see. David Bohm, the quantum physicist, said we ought to have a term called soma significance, that there are things that go on in your life that have significant effects on your body, and throw out this other term because it's been misrepresented and misused. But a psychosomatic illness just says mind and body work together, and you cannot separate them. What I always worry about is that the physician treats the body but not the mind, see, and not the life. Stockbroker friend of mine knows darn well that his intestinal tract acts up when the market's down. As a matter of fact, when he was in the hospital and they had all the vital signs on the door, I added the Dow Jones average. You know, it got him to laugh, but it was to make people aware that what happens to the Dow Jones average is going to reflect what happens to that man's stomach. And it isn't to say he's imagining it or bringing it on himself, but we react in different ways. I discussed neuropeptides or messenger molecules, which are the way our mind and body communicate, not only neurologically, but through chemicals. And if you think about it, when you say, I react, you're breaking my heart or my guts are in knots or whatever, you're sending those same messages to your body. But sometimes those messages aren't healing messages, but are destructive, stressful messages. And I think this is also why I say to people, what part of your body is sick, and what does that mean to you symbolically, you see? Again, not to create guilt and troubles, but let's look at what happens. That the baseball player is not going to stop playing because he has laryngitis, but the radio commentator is going to have a week off with laryngitis. So you may need to have certain parts of your body afflicted to help you control your life. And we need to look at that. And also symbolically, when we say, get off my back, you're breaking my back, the heart problems, and all the things that go on. I have seen two people with cancer of the heart, extremely rare. As a matter of fact, one woman said, the only good thing about it is it's so rare there are no statistics to depress you. But both of these people had lives with broken hearts. And it's incredible to listen to their life stories. As you listen, you say, oh, I know why, it's your heart. Listen to what's happened to you. And they're aware of that, too. And so I say, yes, psyche and soma are one. They speak to each other, and let's learn from them. I want to know why this is happening to you. How can we help your life? How can we redirect it? Then people can go out saying thank you to the doctor, you see, for teaching them and helping them live, as well as working on their disease. But if you only focus on curing disease, yes, you get some people to live longer, but is that worthwhile to them? Is it meaningful to them? Have we really accomplished something for them? And I think on the deep existential level of our existence, of the meaning in our lives, we have to go beyond just curing illness, just fixing broken bones. And that's why I use that term from Hemingway, that life breaks us all into pieces, and some of us are strong at the broken places. I like to help people get strong at the broken places. Then I have done something in their life. There are poor therapists who say to people, you've caused your cancer, you should make it go away. There are friends who say, you're in psychotherapy, how come you're still sick? Those are not the kind of friends or therapists you need. What I'm trying to do is say peace of mind is the focus. We can use the disease to help you figure out what is going on in your life that has made you vulnerable and sick now, to empower you to change your life so indeed the byproduct of the healed life may be the physical improvement and healing. Just getting people to rise and walk doesn't help them live. We can take our medications, and we have lots of nice medications, which I think have really led us away from this whole psychosomatic aspect, because if you have a so-called medical miracle, you know, I have penicillin. You come in with a strep throat. I say, here's your penicillin. Goodbye. But wouldn't it be nice if I said, what's going on in your life? And why are you exhausted? And why do you have a strep throat now? You didn't have it last month. So I always try to focus on how does the disease relate? And if we begin to do that, then we can change lives, and then something very productive comes out of it. So if you do come into my office with an ulcer, I don't pump you full of antacids and hydrogen-blocking agents to reduce the acidity in your stomach and then say goodbye. I might say what's happened at work, what's happened at home, so that you don't have another ulcer and you don't go through surgery when we might have changed your lifestyle and saved you from an operation or years of medication. Peace of mind and our thoughts are what we're in control of. I have one wonderful letter that I might say in summing up from a lady who said, I realized I was in control of my thoughts, not every side effect, not curing my disease, and I want people to know that. She said, you tell us that everybody dies, so dying is not a failure. But I wanted my friends and my therapists to know that controlling every symptom and side effect and bleeding and my white blood count, if I couldn't do that, I wasn't a failure. That what I have to do is learn to love myself. That's my job. And that's really what I say to people. Learn to love yourself, achieve peace of mind, and watch what happens to your body. It may be a wonderful gift that comes along with it. When I see someone in the office who has a diagnosis of a variety of threatening diseases, because I see many people in consultation, you might call second opinion, who say, I don't know what course of therapy to follow. What I do, number one, is give people time to think. I present them with options. I say, here are many options. I will even say, if I had what you had or you were my wife, this is what I would do. And I try to treat them on that level as a human being. But always saying, this is your life, and do you want to live? Do you want to look at the best chances of living? Do you want to look at the statistics to help you decide what to do? Because you might say, if something with potential side effects only improves my chances of surviving 5%, then I won't do that. But you might also say, hey, 5%, I'll go through anything for an extra 5%. And so I get people to look at it in that way. And also to say, if my disease comes back, how will I feel about my choices? So that they are not angry at themselves in the future based on what you're deciding today. That what you decide today is you, your life, your lifestyle, your pattern. I don't yell at people. I don't judge people. Because, again, what I have learned is if I don't judge them and yell at them, they all come back and use the medical profession. And so my ultimate statement would be use yourself, your doctor, your available therapies, and your spiritual faith, and put all of them together as part of your option. Don't leave anything out when you're trying to decide what should I do. If you're one of those patients who comes in and says, look, don't talk to me about anything else. You're the doctor. Yes, I'll take over. But I also say to them, I think you're limiting your options. And if you're not going to participate, it's going to be a little tougher. Ultimately, I know that when you choose something as your form of healing, that the side effects are also diminished. That the person who says, chemotherapy is my way, is going to be very different than somebody who says it's a poison and look what they're doing to me. I see people who say my hair won't fall out, and they literally talk to their scalp, and it doesn't. We had one wonderful little boy. His father was a physical therapist at the hospital. They live in Minnesota, and he was into all this. And so when the boy got his chemotherapy, he said, I have a hair-growing salve, so your hair won't fall out. And he rubbed a salve on his head, and his hair didn't fall out. He was on prednisone and had this terrific appetite, and when the prednisone was done, his appetite diminished. So the father took the bottle, put some vitamin pills in it, and said, here are your appetite pills. And the boy started eating all over again. So it's this wonderful suggestion that can be a part of the process in a positive way as well as a negative way. But it's, again, this mind-body interaction. So make sure it's your commitment. And if you commit yourself to the therapy, you will have a very different reaction to it. You don't have to have all the side effects. You don't even have to read the chemotherapy protocol because that really sets you up for failure. So if you want to, just tell your doctor. If anything comes up, I'll call you, or let, you know, a family member read it and let them be aware. But I really think that knowing all the things that can go wrong just sets you up for trouble. I think when you've looked at the future and what feels right for you, then be comfortable with yourself and your life. And I would say to the doctor, you don't have to agree with me, but this is my life. You may get yelled at. If you do, I'd say get another doctor, really, because you don't want to be torn apart and killed by office visits. another aspect is that I see, because of the work I do, is that a lot of side effects and difficulties are hypnotically induced. For instance, in England, they gave men injections of saline, basically water, said to them, this is chemotherapy, your hair will fall out. 30% had their hair fall out. And so you understand the power of suggestion. I, again, work with people symbolically through dreams, through drawings, through their intellect, and let them make choices. For instance, let me give you an example. Lady called me and said, I don't know whether to have a bone marrow transplant or not. She said, I'm a nurse. I know the dangers of chemotherapy. I know the difficulties of self-healing. I know the dangers of a transplant. I don't know what to do. I said, what are you dreaming about? She said, well, I'm from Hartford, Connecticut, and I dreamt I was in San Antonio, Texas, with my husband and family. We're staying in a high-rise hotel. Down the hall is my friend with a daughter named Dana staying in a room. And I decide we'll stay in San Antonio for my treatment. So I go down the hall, knock on three doors, and ask the people who answer, two gay men and a woman, who should I see and what should I do? And they all tell me to go see Dr. Oslund. And at the end of the letter it said, thank you for helping me decide what to do. And those of you who have heard the dream may say, well, what do you mean? What did she do? Well, listen, in a sense, to the dream. You're in San Antonio, which symbolically represented St. Anthony, the patron saint of lost objects. You go down the hall, and I think the two gay men represent immune system in terms of AIDS, and the woman, I think, represents herself, and they say, go see Dr. Oslund, which was O-S-L-U-N-D. If you translate that from the Latin, it's bone marrow, Oslund. So it's saying, go get a bone marrow transplant, but then you have to say, where do I go? If you live in Hartford, Boston is down the Mass Turnpike. And in Boston is Dana Farber. And what did she tell us? Down the hall is a friend with a daughter named Dana. So the dream says, go get a bone marrow transplant at Dana Farber, which she did. When she got there, she also answered one more thing, because in the dream she was in a high-rise hotel we didn't understand. And when she got to Dana Farber and they took her to the 12th floor, she called me and said, now I know I was in a high-rise hotel. And I think that this lady also had another wonderful symbolic message. As she got her bone marrow transplant, a nurse that she never saw before and not afterwards, the doctor announced, this is your new birthday, here's your bone marrow transplant. The nurse walks in, named Maura, M-A-U-R-A, and she said, that's my real mother's name. And you begin to understand that with that dream and that nurse, everything falls together and you don't have difficulties. That nurse is fine now. It's about 2 or 3 years since that original letter. And you'd say, how does a dream know? But at an intuitive level, we know what is right for us. And there are many times people will say, oh, chemotherapy, I'm afraid of it, or an operating room, I'm afraid of it. And the symbol looks wonderful. At a deep unconscious level, they know that it's good for them when their intellect doesn't. And that's something everybody must understand. We're working at two levels. If your unconscious is opposed to it, you'll get into lots of problems you don't understand when your intellect says, oh, I need this to survive. When they agree, no problem. But when they disagree at both levels, you need to clarify both levels. So we need to deal with your intellectual knowledge and your deep, unconscious, intuitive knowledge and combine them. And I wish every physician would do that. And then they would understand why some people are doing well and others are not. When we are dealing with the side effects of a variety of drugs, therapies, even operations, I think the belief systems become very important. On one extreme, I think the language of medicine is always very destructive. And so when a Quaker friend of mine went to an oncologist who said to him, without knowing he's a Quaker, that here, Dave, is your treatment. I'm going to kill your cancer. Dave got up and walked out and he said, I'm a Quaker. I'm a conscientious objector. I don't kill anything. Now, had that oncologist said to him, Dave, here's some therapy that'll make you well, I think he would have been the best patient he'd ever had on that therapy. See? Dave didn't go home to die, don't get me wrong. I mean, he went home to do other things to try to get well. But I think that this concept was not something he could accept. And I've seen this a lot in the imagery, that initially when this type of imagery came out, the approach was kill, assault, your white cells should be sharks and Pac-Man and German shepherds. And I found that 80% of people, however, are lovers, not killers. And so if you try to convince them to use that imagery, it just doesn't work for them, and they have more troubles. A positive image is really an individual choice. A specific example was a lady who had a cancer that's called an oat cell cancer. She had mares and does eating her oats. See? Another lady said, cancer's awful. How can I ask my white cells to eat that? And then she said, oh, but pigs eat garbage. My white cells will be pigs. So it's a very individual symbolism. It doesn't have to be an aggressive killing kind of picture to get well. And don't think that you have to accept what somebody else says is right for you. Fit what works for you. That's why I really literally get people to draw pictures, because then we can constructively criticize. You might have 10 pounds of cancer and one little pig trying to eat it up. And I say, wait a minute, where are all your white cells? So we can work with that. But I think that from the standpoint of those beliefs, the symbolism also allows me to see that much more. There are many patients, for instance, who will draw X-ray therapy as a beam of sunshine entering their body, and then somebody else, these big black rays from this horrendous monster of a machine, they're going to react very differently to that X-ray. Or if they show a syringe or an IV of chemotherapy, you know, one says it's a bottle of sunshine and energy, and another says it's something horrible coming in, and I don't even accept it. They'll show it, for instance, in the drawing, coming up to their hand but not entering their body, and somebody else will draw it going into the body to the disease. So all these belief systems become important because we do control where blood goes in our body. We can send chemotherapy to certain parts. All these things enter into it. I want to look at that total picture with people because, once more, the intellect that gets you to the doctor doesn't understand why you're throwing up in the waiting room, why you're feeling sick if they put you in a closet to get therapy versus a room with a view of the lake or sound or ocean. And I'm trying to get people to understand that at this deeper level, this unconscious level, there's a lot going on that sometimes says therapy's good for you and sometimes says it isn't. But we want to unify those two belief systems, because there are people who come to my office and say, I really don't want therapy, and the drawing looks wonderful. It's saving their life. And I say, go get it. It's good for you. And watch what happens. And they come back and say, you know, I have terrific response to treatment. The intellect gives in immediately, but when you're having an enormous amount of trouble and side effects, when you're saying, but I want it, and then you look at this horrendous drawing, you say, oh boy, I realize what's going on inside of me at a deeper level and how much fear there is in me. And then we can work on that. And if I can see people before they have the trouble, then it's really very helpful. If it's a few months later, then it's hard to convert. It's like redoing what they've done to themselves in a hypnotic way is very hard to undo. So I'd much rather see people in the beginning when the options are presented them. We can talk about them, we can draw them, and we can look at what makes sense. So I say to people, it's your life, your options. Take charge, take control, participate in all the decisions, because it's you. You have to live with yourself. You can't climb out of your body and leave. So stay there, look in that mirror, accept, and live with your options now, and then you can live with yourself later.